All right, turn in your Bibles, if you would now, to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8. I forgot to charge my iPad, so it might go out on me here sometime in the middle of the service here. Yeah, okay. Let me say that again, my iPad. I forgot to charge my iPad. I thought, man, we're going to have a long night here tonight. That is really okay. Daniel chapter 8. Okay, you're awake now. I get it. Daniel chapter 8. All right. We're transitioning here to the... And this morning we were looking at this chart here of Daniel chapter 2, and then it also added Daniel chapter 7. And had some really good comments. I could tell this morning that everybody was fully engaged, did understand the idea that some are still just trying to piece it together. And I'm moving through it maybe faster than you're catching up. So let's just look at this again. Daniel chapter 2, we see that the vision of the image, that was Nebuchadnezzar's vision of his own dream, and Daniel recorded that, and then you can see in the image there, it has the stone, which is representing the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, not in this chart, other than in the verbiage, does it literally give you then Daniel chapter 7. So I've got another chart here that I will display for you, and that will add then Daniel chapter 7. So you see the image broken up in the portions that we discussed, does a good job of that. The head, which is gold, the silver then of the breast and the arms, and then the belly and the thighs of brass, the legs of iron, but then the feet also of iron, then mingled with clay. That's future events. Now over in the right-hand side, you see Daniel chapter 7 added to that. And the corresponding portion of that image that was included now, but now God's giving it in the form of animals. So the head now becomes a lion with wings as eagles. And that again is still Nebuchadnezzar. Though he had perished by this time, it's still the Babylonian Empire under Belshazzar, his grandson. And then you have the silver then is portrayed as a bear. A bear that was coming up, favoring one side, and three ribs in its mouth. And then we also have then the brass becomes a leopard that has bird's wings, four wings, and four heads. And that's revealing to us that that kingdom is going to be divided upon the death of Alexander the Great, and live on in four pieces, and then one would be absorbed, so it would be three. And here, the artist not knowing how to portray that beast that represents the legs of iron, we have the horns, the ten horns, and the teeth of iron. And so everybody sees the correlation, right? That's Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Is there. We're in Daniel chapter 8 now, and we're going to look at another vision very quickly. We're going to keep moving here because tonight we'd like to get to the 70 weeks of Daniel that are in chapter 9, and then if we have time, we're going to talk about the rapture. And it would be time to talk about the church, which we haven't talked much about. We see already in these two dreams, there's nothing about the church age. 2,000 years are not included in this. And though the feet of iron and clay skip beyond the church age to the end. So we're somewhere in there, I don't know. But God's not revealing to Old Testament prophets at this point anything about our age in this day. So we're going to talk about how do we fit into this as we get into the 70 weeks of Daniel. All right, now in Daniel chapter 8, let's begin reading here in verse 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. That's referring to chapter 7. And I saw in a vision that it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace. which is in the province of Elam, that's in current Iran. If you looked on a map today, you couldn't find Shushan, you would see it as Susa. S-U-S-A is the same place as Shushan. You're going to find that term also in Esther. Esther was in there later, after Daniel. Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And I saw the ram pushing eastward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. Now, stop there. We're going to add that to our chart here. That is the ram. The ram signifies still the silver, the bear, the ram. It's all the same. That is Persia, the Persian Empire. In this dream, God is not going to discuss any longer the Babylonian Empire. There's nothing in this about the Babylonian Empire. In fact, there's only going to be two animals in this dream, not four. And the first one is a ram that we're talking about here. He pushed in three different directions and did according to his own will. He's literally describing the Persian Empire. Now, let me stop and say this, that over the years, Daniel's prophecies have been so accurate, most of them have already been fulfilled. Babylonian Empire, Persian Empire, Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire. They are so accurate that those that have looked at this, as we read in 1 Peter chapter 5, or yeah, well, 2 Peter chapter 3, rather, that shall come in the last day, scoffers, unbelievers have looked at this and said, there is no way that this could have been prophecy. Therefore, rather than believe in God who authored this through Daniel, they would redate Daniel to after the events. Somebody else must have written this. It must have been history in his day because it is so accurate. Now, we won't have time to go through all of the chapters of Daniel to discuss all of these things, but I did want to spend a little time in chapter 8 on these two here. So let's talk about this. It says that he did according to his will at the end of verse 4 and became great. That's the Persian Empire, present day Iran. Verse 5, and as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. That is Greece. So you can see it come right across. The brass now became the leopard with four heads. You say, well, why is God giving all of these different dreams or visions? What's going on here? Well, God is reiterating here truth, future truth, and each time he gives a little more information, something that wasn't known before. For example, in the chapter 7 there, in that middle column, we see that there was a notable horn there. The Antichrist was revealed. Something about the Antichrist. Well, that wasn't in the original vision. There wasn't like a toe that was bigger than the other toes and that toe had a mouth. No, there was nothing there about the Antichrist. Remember, right? And yet in that second vision, now not only was there a revelation of an Antichrist, a notable person, a future person, but that he came out of the Roman part of this. He didn't grow out of the head of Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't come out of the shoulder here of the Persian Empire, but out of the Roman side of this. So we're learning things each time that we go, and that's going to be true here again. There's something unique here about this vision as well. We have now a goat. The goat only has one horn. Now, who do you suppose that horn is? That's Alexander the Great. On the horn, the head of this that indicates the Greek Empire. And that's between his eyes, just one horn. Look at verse 5. Well, we read that. Now look at verse 6. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. So Daniel watches in this vision about a fight that goes on here between these two animals. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, anger. There's anger involved here. And smote the ram and brake his two horns, the two horns indicating the Medes and the Persians. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Wow. Now we look at history and we say, wow, is that what happened? Yeah, that is what happened. Alexander the Great came across the Aegean Sea there, landed in Asia Minor, and of course the Persian Empire, much larger and bigger and mightier and heavy and strong, and they had a battle, and Alexander the Great took the day. He won the battle, and would eventually, he won that battle, but after going to Egypt, he would go out there to the home of Persia, Iran, and he would destroy the Persian Empire and absorb it, Alexander the Great. It's interesting. I forgot to point this out. Notice in verse 5 it says, and touch not the ground. Touch not the ground. How can that be that this animal, this he-goat, would touch not the ground? And have you ever seen cartoon drawings where in one frame of a cartoon, the artist needs to depict that something is going so fast? Like, how do you do that in just a frame? Well, its legs are not touching the ground. It's, you know, doing this thing. That honestly is. We get from this and what is said that he moves so quickly. The leopard that had four wings, not two, four. And here, even so precise, God is telling us that Alexander the Great moved so quickly that he overwhelmed his enemies with speed. All right, anyway, moving on, showing you the precision. The choler, the anger in verse 7 was simply this, that the Persians had attacked the Greeks years before Alexander the Great. There were Greco-Persian wars, and it went back and forth, the mighty Persian Empire fighting against the Greeks. Well, Alexander the Great wasn't technically a Greek. I don't know if you knew that. He was not Greek. He was not born in Greece. His dad wasn't born in Greece. He wasn't from Greece. Now, his education was from Greece. Aristotle was his tutor. But he was not from Greece. His mother was from Albania. Like, he wasn't Greek. Where was Alexander the Great from? Macedonia. Macedonia is north of Greece. Don't go to Macedonia and call them Greeks. They wouldn't appreciate that. Okay? But his father, Philip II, conquered the Greeks, something that the Persians hadn't been able to do, and he kind of joined them together and became the king of the Greeks, the city-states there, Athens, Sparta, and others. And Alexander the Great would inherit that upon the death of his father. So, but he's not technically Greek. He's Macedonian. Nevertheless, he inherited the ire, the bitterness that the Greeks had toward the Persians. So here he comes, not just to conquer additional lands. Well, I'm not really upset with you. I just want your land. No, he was upset with them because the Persians had fought in the Battle of Marathon. They had fought against the Greeks and later in the Battle of Thermopylae and had destroyed Athens at that time. That was before Alexander the Great. So that explains the choler here, that in this particular notable time, there's going to be anger, and that is Alexander the Great. Verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Wow. The great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now, we talked about that this morning. Alexander the Great died. Do You understand that Daniel seeing this in a vision hasn't happened yet. This is 200 years after Daniel. More than 200 years. This is why, you know, historians look at this and they say, no way, there's no way. It describes events very accurately, very precise. The Bible is trustworthy. Of course, God, who lives in eternity, it's not a problem for him. He sees it all, knows it all, is involved in it all. So it's not a problem for him to reveal a little more. See, in this third vision, we're getting more than we did. All we had was four heads. We didn't really know about it. Alexander the Great, we know more about it. Now notice this. Verse 9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn. All right, so we have one horn coming forth out of four horns. Out of one of the four, another horn is growing out of that horn, which waxed exceedingly great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. Wonder what that is. Yeah, that's Israel. You got it. Wow, is this precise. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking in the vision, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall there be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, until 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now, let's talk about this. We can't go too far. We've got to stop and understand what's going on here. This notable horn, this small horn growing out of another horn, and he's growing out the head of this animal. Does it, what empire does it depict? What empire are we talking about? Where is this horn coming from? Man, if you've got your notes right there, you're thinking, do you remember which one it is? Is it Babylonian? Is it Persian? Is it Greek? Or is it Roman? It's coming out of the he-goat. It's Greek. This notable horn is coming out of the Greek Empire. Particularly, it's growing out of one of the horns of the Greek Empire. One of the four. Okay, just hold that thought. Now wait, didn't we talk about a notable horn, a small horn this morning? In chapter 7, what did that horn grow out of? Okay, I heard it over here. Is everybody caught up to that? What empire did that horn grow out of? The Roman Empire. Remember? That horn came out of that nasty beast there that's showing across from the legs. A terrifying and frightening beast. There were 10 horns, and one of those then subdued other three, ripped them out by the roots, and established himself with the 10. Okay, now wait a minute. Those horns are not in the same... Right. They're not the same people. This horn in Daniel chapter 8 is not, at least not initially, the Antichrist. No. He's coming out of the Greek Empire. He's coming out of one of the four we talked about, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Seleucids in Syria, Ptolemies in Egypt. Which one of these did that horn come out of? The Seleucids. This is not the Antichrist. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. Maybe you've heard of him. He lived about 160, 170 years before Christ. He's a type of the Antichrist. So let me tell you a quick story here. Let me tell you a quick story, and then we've got to move into Daniel chapter 9. Now, this is important because it's prophecy. And some of this has already occurred, but not all of it. So even as I tell you the story, I am telling you not only what has happened, but what is going to happen. All right, so Antiochus Epiphanes, or some say Antiochus Epiphanes, was Syrian. His father was Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great. That was his father. And he fought between himself and another general of Alexander the Great's who was down in Egypt, the Ptolemies. And they fought, and remember I said this morning, what's in between Syria and Egypt, right? Israel, the pleasant land. So here they are, trampling over Israel to get to each other, these big guys, if we can say it that, these bullies. And initially Antiochus III won against Egypt. And when he did, he took Palestine out of the control of the Egyptians, which is where it was following Alexander the Great's time. Now it belongs to Syria. And that's going to set up, yes, the influence from the Hellenists. That's another term for Greek. Hellenistic. Culture of the Greeks. And that's up in Syria. Now, the king there, Antiochus III, dies and leaves his son in charge. There was a little bit of malpractice going on there between brothers, but Antiochus IV takes power in Syria. He's the horn. He doesn't treat Israel as well as his father did. And he's still at war with Egypt. In about 168, 167 BC, this is before Christ, he goes down, he attacks Egypt, he wins an initial battle, and marches right into, this is going to be described later in Daniel in very great detail. He's going to go down there, he is Antiochus IV, and he goes down and he conquers Egypt. But he doesn't, like, destroy them. And he goes home. Now, his problem is that there is a growing empire in the West called the Roman Empire. They have not come into full strength yet. They're like a juvenile empire. But he's watching them because they're growing. And he's trying to stay out of their way. And so he's part of the older Greek empire of Alexander the Great, but there's that new empire depicted by the legs up there that he's watching over. In a couple of years, he's going to go back down to Egypt and try to finish the job. He comes with a fresh army. He's ready to go down there and take care of business. And on his way, he's almost there, he is met by a single old man in his path, who halts him where he is. Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, is halted by an old man standing there. This man is an ambassador from Rome who's been watching all that's going on over here and has been dealing with its own problems, the Carthaginian Wars and other things, but is very much interested in what's happening over here in this eastern side of the Mediterranean. And now he's sent this older man, an ambassador, to stand here and halts Antiochus and says to Antiochus, the Roman Senate would like to know what your intentions are. And of course, he knew what that means. It means leave Egypt alone. And he says, well, Antiochus understands that though he could kill this man right here, it would bring him into war with the Roman Empire, and he didn't want that. So he said to this older man, he said, I'll tell you what, I'll get with my council, my war council, and I'll get you an answer here. We'll figure out how we're going to work through this. And this ambassador comes over with his staff, and he walks around Antiochus Epiphanes. With his staff, he puts it in the sand outside of Egypt, and he makes a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes. And he comes back and he stands in front of him. And he says, the Roman Senate would like an answer before you step out of that circle. Have you ever heard the phrase, the line in the sand? That's where it comes from. Yeah. And Antiochus knew he'd been had. He had to give an answer right now. And so he said, I guess we're going home. And that was it. Now, okay, why is that such a big deal? He's got an army. He came down here to do a job. He's been embarrassed now by a man in front of him, an older man standing in front of him. And he has to turn his army around and head back to Syria with nothing. Now, back in Israel, rumors came in, fake news came in, that Antiochus had a big battle down there and he'd been killed in battle. And they were having celebrations in Jerusalem. Well, they hadn't died. Frankly, his army wasn't even exhausted. They were fresh for a fight. And on the way home, he found out what was going on in Jerusalem, that they were celebrating his death, and he hadn't died. And he was mad. And he came home, on his way home, he stopped off in Jerusalem, and the killing began. This is that horn right there, who pushed in different directions and did his own thing. Now, I think in verse 10, look at that horn, and it waxed great even to the host of heaven and cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them, and he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. Verses 10 and 11, there's a little bit of a transition, a little bit of a look forward, because he typifies the Antichrist. Now, the horn of Daniel chapter 8 here is literally Antiochus Epiphanes, who then was so angry in 167, demanded that that Zerubbabel's temple that sits on the Temple Mount, Herod's temple has not yet been built, Herod's not born yet, he commands that an idol to Zeus be placed in the temple, that pigs be sacrificed on the altars of the temple, desecrating the temple. And that's what happened here. And he commanded that the Jews no longer practice Judaism, any kind of Judaism. They can't circumcise their boys by law. Thousands of Pharisees were executed. It was a terrible time here. It's 164 BC when finally there was an uprising called the Maccabean Revolt. The time that we're in, by the way, is in between the book of Malachi and the book of Matthew. What we're talking about right now is not recorded in Scripture other than the prophecy that Daniel received about it. Because there's nothing between Malachi and Matthew but 400 years. And these events we're talking about happened inside of those 400 years until the Messiah comes. Let's drop down now to verse 27. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. Well, we understand it more now as we look back to this, that the temple was desolated here. I need to help you with one more thing as we come up upon Christmas here. In 164, this Maccabean revolt finally fought its way. It was winning against the Seleucids. The Jews were winning in their rebellion. And 3 years into it, they finally fought their way back into Jerusalem to their temple and came into the temple building. It was a mess. It was a wreck. And you can't go in there and just sacrifice to God now. The place is desecrated. What they needed to do was to light the menorah, the large candlestick. Don't think it's a small thing. We have little models of it. No, the thing, I've seen the replica that they have prepared to go into the new temple. It's about this big. And it requires pure olive oil to light that right there. And they need to get it. It's never supposed to go out. It's not supposed to go out. And it was out. So fighting their way back into the temple, they not only need to cleanse the temple, they need to light the menorah. And as they came in, these Maccabeans, as they came in, they could only find enough oil to light it for one day. It has to be pure olive oil. You can't just go to the market, go to the supermarket, and get oil that goes in the menorah. It has to be pure olive oil certified by the priests. There was only enough there for one day. It would take 7 days for these men to, now there's different stories here, to cleanse themselves because they've been in battle. They've killed people. They are unclean for 7 days. Then it's going to take an additional day to make pure olive oil. So they've got 8 days is the soonest that they could reproduce or manufacture pure olive oil. And they only have 1 day's worth. They lit the menorah. And the oil that would only last 1 day lasted 8 days. That is the Feast of Hanukkah. So when you say Happy Hanukkah, that's what you're talking about. You're not saying Merry Christmas. Jews don't celebrate Christmas. They don't believe in Jesus. Baby that came in a manger, Hanukkah to them celebrated nearly the same time, and we say, oh, that's the Jewish Christmas. No, not really. It depicts the defeat of Antiochus and the cleansing of the temple in 164 A.D. I'm sorry, B.C. During those 400 years. And that is now commemorated by Jews all over the world as the Feast of Hanukkah. That God did a miracle and olive oil that should have only lasted 1 day lasted 8. Until they could make new pure olive oil and keep the menorah lit. In the meantime, they cleansed the temple. All right. Given you all that, not so much prophecy. There's a little bit of history, but it belongs to the Christmas season. And if you come across Jews, you'll understand a little bit more about what Hanukkah means to them. And you say, well, all of that, did it really happen? I don't know. I mean, that's what history tells us. Some are skeptical about that miracle and all of that. I don't have a Bible verse to tell you that the oil lasted that long. It came between Malachi and Matthew. We don't have a verse on it. So this is a historical event, and this is what's been passed down in history. And I'm fine with it, but here we go. We're going to keep moving along. So we go to Daniel chapter 9 now. Daniel chapter 9. In Daniel chapter 9, it opens, and we can't spend the time with it, so I'm just going to kind of paraphrase to you. Daniel chapter 9, the first couple of verses, Daniel discovers in his old age, he somehow gets his hand on a book of the Bible that, I don't know, that he hadn't seen before. It's called Jeremiah. It was written by a friend of his. It's true. Now, had Daniel ever met Jeremiah? I don't know. I don't have a verse that says that he did. I think Jeremiah was roughly 20 years older than Daniel. Jeremiah wasn't taken to Babylon. He stayed in Israel. He ministered in Israel. While Daniel and Ezekiel were both in Babylon. Jeremiah is writing his scroll, writing the book of Jeremiah from Israel. And somehow Daniel in Babylon gets his hands on this new book of the Bible, a new scroll. And he reads it. And in that book, he reads the prophecy of Jeremiah that their people are going to be in captivity in Babylon for 70 years. Well, Daniel, an old man now, starts counting because he was brought there in the first year, 605. And so he's counting away and he's, wait a minute. 70 years is almost up. And he's probably like 80 something. He goes, it's almost up. Now you would think that he would be excited and he'd have a party. And you'd think that Daniel chapter 9 would be all about a party that Daniel threw. Hey, we're about ready to get out of here. No, it's not. It's about a prayer meeting. Because Daniel realized that the sinful nation that had been expelled from their homeland was still sinful. And if we don't get right with our God, we're likely to stay here. And the 70 years is up, and it's time for us to wake up and get right with God. And it is an unbelievable prayer where Daniel is confessing, listen to this, his own sin, which we don't even know what it is. Like, did Daniel really sin? No sins are ever recorded where Daniel messed up when he made a wrong choice, when he violated God's law. There's no verse on it. We just have Daniel chapter 9 where Daniel goes, oh, I'm wicked. I'm a sinner. Of course he's a sinner, but it's not recorded that way. He just is a humble guy, and he confesses the sin of his nation through the first verses here of Daniel 9. We don't have time to go through it. You can look at that yourself. Look at verse 20. We pick it up here. And this is going to be just some key information that we're going to need. This older man now, he's not going to live much longer. He'll never make it himself back to Israel. He says, and whilst I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yea, whilst I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, do you know who he is? Whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly. Wow, do angels fly? Of course they do. That's what it says. Touched me about the time of the evening oblation. Wow. How far did Gabriel have to go? I don't know. If he was at the throne of God, when Daniel began to pray, which was just a little while ago, and God says, Gabriel, I want you to get down there to Daniel. That'd be quite a flight. From the throne? If that crosses the universe, angels can move. Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. He doesn't just say, hey, Gabriel appeared. No, Gabriel's caused to fly swiftly. I don't think Gabriel was out of breath. I don't know. What do you think? Like, Daniel's like, Gabriel, you need a minute? Like, you need to catch your breath? I don't know. I don't think so. Wow. A little bit of information here about angels. 21. Yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, shows up, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. Remember he said, I don't understand. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee. For thou art greatly beloved, therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. Now here it is. This is the message that Gabriel brought to Daniel, and you and I get to listen in on this. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thine holy city for this purpose, to finish the transgressions and to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand, Gabriel said, that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks, and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation. And that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. There's a lot in there right there. The 70 weeks of Daniel. All right. It seems like really hard to understand, but it's not so much. Understand, first of all, that this, what he's getting right now, is an answer to prayer. Let's just stop for a minute. A saint, no different than you. A sinner saved by grace. Yes, in the Old Testament. You know they were saved by grace in the Old Testament too? Yeah, amen. Faith. Faith accesses grace every time. So Daniel prays. And don't you know that all the while he's praying, an angel is coming, caused to fly swiftly. The answer is on the way. Right? You ought to know the same thing, that when you're praying, the answer is coming. God has heard. He's not like, oh, I'll get to it at some point. He's working right now. It might take some time. You may not have your answer the same day, but God is working. You have not because you asked not. Daniel asked, and God sent the answer. So here he is. Gabriel is here, and he says this. 70 weeks. Now, if you're taking notes, you're going to want to know this. If you're not, then you've got to get this in your mind. The Hebrew word for weeks here isn't technically week. It's sevens. Properly translated, this would be 70 sevens are determined upon thy people. It doesn't have to be a week, but in this case, it's a week of sevens. 70 periods of weeks. So we have each week is 7 years. 70 sevens are determined upon thy people. That would be the most natural way to say this. 70 sevens. The sevens are years, not 7 days. Are determined upon thy people. In other words, God is giving to Daniel a calendar, a time schedule. So 70 times 7 years is how many years? 490 years. And Daniel's saying, you've got 490 years left. And at the end of 490 years, it's the end of whatever he said here. Wow, this is going to be, there's going to be a desolation here, but then there's going to be the end. At the end of the 77s, the end of 490, that's the end. That's the end. Wow. That's pretty interesting. Coming from Gabriel, that was about 2,500 years ago. What happened to 490? Because this was 2,500 years ago. Okay. Hold that thought. How would you like to, I'm going to ask a personal question here. How would you like to know that you are not a born again Christian? I'm assuming now that you're born again, that you're not going to be on earth for the tribulation. Would that be okay? Would that be like good news? Okay. Well, that's what this says. This is what this says. I know there's people out there that believe in post-tribulation. That means the Christian, the church is going to go through the tribulation. That's not what this says. I am going to show you now from Daniel chapter 9, how we know for sure that you are not going to go through the tribulation. This isn't the only proof text we have. I'll show you more. This makes it clear in this way. Gabriel is talking to Daniel. Bear with me now. And he said, 70 weeks are determined upon whom? What does it say? Yeah, it says thy people. Is that America? Are there any Gentiles in there? No. Thy people. So whatever this 70 times 7, this 490 has to do with, it doesn't have to do with you. It doesn't have anything to do with me. We can study it. We should. We should understand it. Absolutely. It's in our Bible. It doesn't have anything to do with the church. Nothing. Are you getting this? You have that down. That right there is one of the strongest arguments that you have that the church is not going to go through the tribulation. Okay, you say, I just don't get that yet. You will. Understand this. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and, there's an end there. Boy, if the end says, and the church, we're in trouble. But it doesn't say that. It says what? And? What is that? Where is that? Is that in Ohio? Holy city in Ohio? Toledo, maybe? Cincinnati? Where is that? Jerusalem. So the 70 weeks apply to Daniel and his people. They apply to that city. And the purpose is what it says there in verse 24. To finish the transgression. And to make an end of sins. And to make reconciliation for iniquity. Israel, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. When has that happened yet? Has everlasting righteousness been brought in? Look around. I don't think so. Okay, we just had an election. Did that bring in everlasting righteousness? Okay, no, it didn't. Okay, we're still looking for that. And to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Truly, the end of the 490 is the end. Okay, but it happened 2,500 years ago. Well, then he goes on to explain. So let's look at verse 25. Know therefore and understand. Can you just, Gabriel's talking to you and me now. So he's saying, come on, get this. You got to get this. That from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. All right, 7 weeks. That's 7 times 7. 7 sevens. So how many years is that? 49. Then we have 62. 62 is 62 sevens. How many is 62 sevens? 432? All right. If you add those two together, you have 483. You're a week short. You're 7 short of the 490. So this is in 3 periods. I'm going to put a chart up there in just a minute that's going to help you see it, visualize it. There's 3 different time periods here. The first one is 49 years. The second one is that 62 weeks. So 1 week and 62 weeks, and the final one, well, no, 7 weeks, and then 62, and then the 1 week is left. 1 week. One period of 7. 7 years. You know what that is. That's the tribulation. Now, 69 of these periods are already finished. They're already done. So let me put this chart up here, and then we're going to work our way through it. Daniel 70 weeks. All right, let me step out of the way here. The command to restore Jerusalem, that's going to come after Daniel is already dead. So this is all prophecy to Daniel. In 445 BC, the command is going to go forth for Israel to return to their homeland. 70-year captivity is done. And they're going to begin to rebuild the walls and the temple. That's going to be finished after 7 weeks or 49 years right here. Completion of building program. The date? 396. Okay, wow. Did that happen that way? Yeah. That is what happened. Wow. Like, you can bank on this? Yeah. God's got it. He knows what's going on here. The whole thing now in red here is a total of 69 weeks. Seven of them here, 62 here. And so then from the completion of the building until Messiah is cut off, they're all looking for the Messiah to come, but it's till he is cut off. Now, scholars have taken this down to the day. In the Jewish calendar is different than our calendar, the Gregorian calendar. They've taken the Jewish calendar, and they've taken it down to 173,000 some days. And they have taken it down to the very day, to the time when Christ did his triumphal entry into Jerusalem before his crucifixion, and it's to the day. 69 weeks, 483 years from the time that the command was given to restore Jerusalem, which that command was written down, and they know exactly what day it was, on March the 14th of 445 BC. This is very accurate. Okay? So 69 weeks of the 70 had already happened when Christ was cut off or crucified. We have 1 week to go. Right here. Now this is not to scale. There's 69 of them in here. There's only a week to go here, but they had to have enough room for all this information. There's 1 week, 7 years, 483 years. 7 years. Okay, everybody's got it? Now what's in the middle of those two? The church age. Okay, in other words, Gabriel told Daniel, the clock is going to start when the decree goes forward. The clock began ticking. He said, you got 490 years. The clock began. 2,500 years ago, the clock began. And it moved. And it was accurate. It stayed on. And when Jesus was crucified, what happened to the clock? The clock stopped. It stopped. There's only 7 years to go. And the clock isn't moving. You can pick up the clock and shake it and throw it on the floor and jump on it. It's not moving. It hasn't been moving for 2,000 years. Why? Because the age we're living in is not about Israel. This is the church. This is the church. I'm not saying Israel's not important. I'm not saying Israel's been destroyed. I'm not saying Israel's been replaced. Frankly, the point of this whole thing is Israel hasn't been replaced. There's another week out here that Israel is going to, the clock is going to begin again. Wow, the clock just began. Yeah. We only have 7 years, right? Yeah, right. You don't want to live in that time period. What is this for? Why 7 more years? Gabriel just told us to finish the whole process. Let's look at that again. What is this 7 weeks for? He said to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. That's what's going to happen when the thing hits 490. It's going to be done. Well, what is it going to take for Israel to finally wake up and understand all of that? It's going to take that final week. Hey, 483 years. 69 weeks have already ticked off the clock. How's Israel doing? Do they get it? Like, are they partway there? No. No, they're not there. The age that we're in is not about Israel. Okay, let me illustrate this a little further. Again, I'm not saying Israel's not important. I love Israel, and Israel's still the people of God. But Israel right now is still awaiting the 70th week. And by the way, this is in the Old Testament. They should know this. This isn't New Testament where they go, oh, we don't believe that New Testament stuff. This is in the Old Testament. They could mark this down just the way that we're learning it and realize we only have a week to go. Right. Okay. In the Old Testament, could a Gentile get saved? Yes or no? Are you sure? Could a Gentile get saved in the Old Testament? Okay, wasn't the Old Testament about Israel? I mean, it was Israel was leading out. Israel was the people of God. Who received the law? The world? No, Israel did. Right. God was their God. But yes, a Gentile could definitely get saved. Of course. Is God a respecter of persons? Not at all. Boy, he loves everybody. Doesn't matter where you were on the planet. You know, even in BC, before Christ, he loved every single one. When he died on the cross, Jesus, he died for the sins of the world. He loved everybody. They could have been living in a cave somewhere in northern Canada. Whatever. I love you as much as I love Israel. True story. He died for everybody. It's not an afterthought. Okay. Can you think of a Gentile in the Old Testament who did get saved? Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, good. Give me another one. I'm hearing different things. Rahab? Ruth. Did they have to receive the God of Israel to be saved? Was there any other God to receive? Is the Messiah coming through Israel? Did he come unto his own and his own received him not? And when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman made in America? Made under the law. What's that mean? Made under the law. What's that mean? The Jews. Made under the law to redeem them that were under the law. That's what he came for, his own people. We've been grafted in. We've been given a privilege. It was part of God's plan from the beginning. It's not an afterthought, I understand. But Israel's the focus. In the Old Testament, it's Israel. If Gentiles wanted to be saved, they came to the God of Israel. What did Ruth say? Thy people shall be my people. Thy God shall be my God. While her mother-in-law is telling her, go back. Oh, no, 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 no. Go back to your own people. It says Orpah's already gone back to her family and her gods, Naomi said. Go back. And Ruth said, your people will be my people. Your gods, my God. Was she assimilated into the nation of Israel? Yeah, she's the great-grandmother of King David. The Messiah came through both Rahab and Ruth. Rahab would end up being Ruth's mother-in-law. Two Gentiles. In the Old Testament, you came to Israel to be saved. You at least accepted their God. You had to come by faith to Israel. Okay, let me ask you a question. Post-cross now, in this time period when the clock has stopped, Israel is still there. They're God's covenant people. They always will be. And God has a plan for them, right? There's 7 weeks yet coming. But right now, if a Jew gets saved, can he get saved? A Jew, 100%. A Jew. Can he be saved? When he gets saved, when the church goes up in the rapture, what will happen to that Jew? Will he be raptured? Or will he stay behind? No, he's going to be raptured. Why? Because he's part of the church. Well, of course he is, but right. The church is God's plan for this age. Even a Jew who gets saved is going to be, I'm not saying he's coming to church. I'm saying he's part of the bride of Christ. He's going up in the rapture. So the plan for Israel has stopped. It's on hold right now. It's going to start again when the church is gone. And then it's going to start. And the final week of Daniel will take place. The important thing for us right here, dear believer, is that those 70 weeks have nothing to do with us. Do you understand that? Nothing to do with us. Other than we can learn them, and we should, and we can understand them, and we need to, and we could preach it, absolutely. But then we could be very thankful that that's not our time clock. You know what our clock is? Christ's return is imminent. Do you know what that means? We don't have a clock on it. There's no time. Some of the things, well, but look at the signs that have to come. Those signs in the scriptures in Matthew 24, 25 have nothing to do with the rapture. They have to do with the second coming. There are no signs. The signs are done. Christ could come at any moment. Any moment. Nothing needs to happen before Christ's return. We don't have a clock like that. Israel does. Right. So are we going to be included in the 70th week of Daniel? No. No, 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 no. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. There's not a holy city in America. It's not, you know, I'm being a little facetious, but he wasn't talking to us. So we're going to be out of here. That is one of the texts right there. And I wanted to spend the time on it because I want you to understand not only what the 70th weeks of Daniel are. Let me just finish this up real quick. And we'll look at some of this tomorrow. So if you didn't have thoughts that you would return tomorrow, you should return tomorrow. Here's the 70th week. It's split into two. The first 3.5 years and the second 3.5 years. 42 months, 3.5 years. A time and a times and a dividing of times. 3.5 years, 42 months. There's going to be two periods of those. And in the middle part of that right there is when the temple in Israel, which is not even there yet, but it will be desecrated in the same manner that Antiochus Epiphanes did. In the same manner. Like, the Jews can't say, well, that'll never happen, because they know it already did once. Nobody would ever walk into our temple and crucify or kill pigs in there and set up an idol in there. Revelation says it will happen. It is going to happen. Right in the mid period. We're going to be talking about it this week. And then at the end, right here, the second coming of Christ is the Battle of Armageddon. Then there's going to be a brief period, and we go into the millennial kingdom, 1,000 years. And at the end of that, the Great White Throne Judgment, after another great battle described in Revelation. There's still a lot here. Hopefully, though, we've got it at least sorted out here that there's a part of this that is for Israel, a big part of it. There's a part of it that's for us, but really all we're waiting for is simply this. We're waiting for our groom to come. If you're born again, you're his bride. Male or female, doesn't matter. You are the bride of Christ. You are. And right now, Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. And he was looking at you like his bride. Those are terms that have to do with the bride. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself. That's the rapture. That's a little peek into another passage. And I'll give you two more beyond that that prove to you that the church is not going to enter the tribulation period. But I think foundationally, Daniel chapter 9 is the biggest part of it. So as we continue, there's still much more to go over. And we're trusting the Lord will show us real truth. Let's bow our heads. Lord, we're thanking you that Israel has not been done away with, that you still have a plan for them also. Stubborn as they are in rejecting their own Messiah, hard to imagine. But then, Lord, you died for my sin, rejecting you just as much as theirs. So I pray, Lord, that you would cause us to remember and to be thankful for the redemption that we have in Christ, the Messiah, the Redeemer of Israel, has also provided our way of escape. And I thank you for it in Jesus' name. Amen.